Good afternoon. So today I'm going to be speaking on a topic that's almost not really about libertarianism at all, because there's not too much you need to say about discrimination from a libertarian point of view. You have a right to do it, and that's really all I have to say. So if I was to speak on that topic, I'd be done. And so what I want to talk about instead is the logical and moral dynamics behind discrimination. And this is not to suggest that you don't have a right to discriminate if you're doing it badly, but simply that that's something that I'd like to analyse. And I think it's important to analyse that, because there's this thing I hear sometimes. Someone will be talking and they'll be talking about an instance they've seen where they think something unfair has happened, and they'll say, it's discrimination. And then they stop talking. And I wait and wait for the elaboration, the explanation of why is this wrong, and it doesn't necessarily come. And if you inquire into that further, people are almost shocked to have to defend or elaborate on that statement. To them, it seems self-evident that once something's identified as discrimination, we all ought to be on board that that's just outrageous. And so I'd like to have a little bit of a deeper look at, well, are there instances in which discrimination is rational or moral or irrational, immoral, and so on? And so I'll be talking today about, as you can see, the anti-discrimination paradigm. And I'd just like to explain what I mean by that. So by the anti-discrimination paradigm, I mean, broadly speaking, the kind of philosophical and political critique that you hear against discrimination, saying, broadly speaking, that discrimination is bad. Now, it's a bit more specific than this, and people will generally say discrimination on certain grounds should be forbidden, and common verboten characteristics that one should not discriminate with are things like race, sex, age, perhaps sexuality, by which I mean sexual preference, pregnancy status, disability, family responsibilities, religion, maybe political opinions, and the list expands over time. But there doesn't seem to be any particular limiting principle evident in that paradigm. And at root, it's a view that discrimination per se is bad. These are some little banners from various lobby groups and bureaucracies that advocate anti-discrimination law and work within that field. And you can see the general tenor of what they say. Speak up, stop discrimination, don't put up with it, don't let them get away with it. Stop discrimination now. And the middle one, I think, is the most important, which is to say discrimination of any kind is wrong. And this is what I take the anti-discrimination paradigm to be, this idea that discrimination per se is a bad thing. This, incidentally, is codified essentially in the UN International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 26, and they make statements that say, the law shall prohibit any discrimination and guarantee to all persons equal and effective protection against discrimination on any ground, such as race, colour, sex, language, etc. But evident in that idea is a kind of hostility to discrimination broadly, rather than just on the basis of specific things. So in order to analyse this, I want to talk about a particular kind of decision problem that people sometimes face. I've called it here a discrimination problem, but that's probably begging the question a little bit, because we want to find out if discrimination makes sense in this problem. I'm going to imagine that we have some decision to make pertaining to another person. It might be, will I hire this person for my company? Will I date this person? If I'm a taxi driver, perhaps, will I pick this person up in my taxi? Will I leave my belongings with this person if I need to pop off to the toilet somewhere? Whatever it happens to be, some decision problem where you're relying on another person in some capacity, relying on what their actions might be. Now, to make sure we don't overcomplicate the situation, I want to just look at whether discrimination might arise rationally in this kind of situation, and whether that would be morally okay. So in order to not complicate this further, I'm going to assume some morally acceptable goal. So whatever you think is a morally acceptable goal, imagine we have a decision problem of that nature, where the goal being achieved, at least we have no objection to that. And we'll look at whether we have an objection to the means by which we try to achieve that. The example I'm going to use comes from a study done in the 1980s in Washington, D.C., by a group, I think they were called the Washington, D.C. Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. They had noticed and basically done a study into the fact that taxi drivers in Washington, D.C. were less likely to pick up a young black man who flagged a taxi than someone else of a different demographic group. And so what would quite often happen is a young black man waves for a taxi, taxi drives past, even though it's available for customers generally. And so they did a study into this and confirmed that indeed empirical evidence suggested that that was indeed the case, this was occurring, and there was a call obviously for that to not occur anymore, for that to be banned. So I'm going to have a look at that particular decision problem a little more closely. And so our decision problem here, we're going to put ourselves in the situation of the taxi driver, and he sees a young black man signal for his taxi to stop, and we'll suppose that we're in 1980s Washington, D.C., where this was occurring. He knows that this is a high-risk demographic group. We'll talk about what that means later. His decision is simply, should I stop and let this guy into my taxi, or should I drive past him? Now, the goal is, in my view, the morally acceptable goal. He wants to get a taxi fare. He wants to avoid assault. So I don't think we have any problems with that goal, but we're going to look at what things might this person legitimately take into account in deciding what decision to make. To do that, I'm going to consider all the possible characteristics that this person has, and I'm going to demarcate them into a few categories. And firstly, I'm going to distinguish between what I will call merit characteristics and non-merit characteristics. And what I mean by that is something is a merit characteristic of this person if it directly impacts the getting of that goal. So this young black man waving for a taxi has certain characteristics, and some of those characteristics directly impact whether the taxi driver will achieve his goal of getting a taxi fare and avoiding assault. But some of the characteristics he has don't have any direct relationship to that. And so I'll call that distinction merit characteristics versus non-merit characteristics. Also, a second distinction is that some of the characteristics of this person are observed, available to the knowledge of the taxi driver, and some are not. And so this gives us a four-part classification. If we put merit characteristics and non-merit characteristics as the rows, observed and unobserved characteristics as the columns, we can put any characteristic of this person into one of those groups. So to take the merit characteristics first, the kinds of things that are merit characteristics, meaning they directly impact the goal of trying to get taxi fare and avoid assault. Well, firstly, the fact that this guy's waving for a taxi, indicating he wants a taxi, so that's helpful to the goal. Whether or not he actually has taxi fare, actually has the capacity to pay. Whether or not he has an intention to pay as opposed to an intention to rob the driver or run off before paying the fare. Now, some of this is observed. Waving for a taxi is observed. Some of these things are unobserved. Does he have taxi fare? Can't see that. Does he intend to pay? We don't know yet. Non-merit characteristics are any other characteristic about this person which doesn't directly impact on that goal. So his race, sex, age, the clothing he's wearing, things like that, his favourite breakfast cereal, what movies he's enjoyed recently, all of these kinds of things that don't impact on the goal in the decision problem at hand. And again, some of those are observed. And so in this particular case, the taxi driver will probably observe this guy for no more than 10, 15 seconds. He'll be able to tell the person's race, sex, approximate age, have a look at his clothing. He might get a slight look at his kind of demeanour and activity for that small period of time. Other things are unobserved, like his favourite breakfast cereal. Now, out of those four categories, we can rule one out immediately, which is this one, as irrelevant. The unobserved non-merit characteristics can't be relevant to the decision here. Because they're unobserved, the taxi driver can't use them as a basis for decision. And because they're non-merit characteristics, he has no desire to try to infer what those characteristics are. So to him, it is simply irrelevant what this guy's favourite breakfast cereal is. Another category of characteristics are the unobserved merit characteristics. Now, of course, being unobserved, they can't be used in the making of the decision, but being merit characteristics, we do want to know those things because they impact the goal. And so this is something that we want to try to infer, need to infer this bit. Well, the other two classes of observed information are what we can potentially use for this inference. I sometimes, when I teach statistics to students, I say to them that statistical theory or statistical science is the art of good guessing. It tells us how to guess unknown things well from things we do know. So this is the kind of statistical problem we're faced with in this case. We have some observed information, those two orange categories, and we have an unobserved piece of information, that yellow category, that we would like to infer. Now, that kind of structure sets up a phenomenon that's been fairly widely written about called rational discrimination. And I'll just give you a bit of a rundown about how rational discrimination works in this kind of context. And because I'm a mathematician, I'm going to put little x, y, and r variables to these things. Okay? So I'm going to say, call x and y our merit characteristics, x being the observed merit characteristics, y the unobserved, and r are our non-merit characteristics that are observed. So think r for race in this particular example. R for race, x for observed things that impact the decision. Y are those things that we don't know but we want to know. Now, the best decision obviously depends on x and y. They're our merit characteristics. But y is unobserved. So what do we do? Well, we want to make an inference about this using our observed information. We're trying to make a best guess. And as I said, statistics is the art of good guessing. So we want to turn to the principles of statistical inference to tell us how would we do this. Now, category X, the observed merit characteristics, are relevant in two ways. Because they're merit characteristics, they're directly relevant to the goal trying to be achieved. But in addition to that, they might also give some information to assist us in inferring the unobserved merit characteristics. Now, this category down here is more interesting, category R, the observed non-merit characteristics. Intuitively, one might think, and indeed a lot of people do think, that anything that's not a merit characteristic ought not be something that we should discriminate on in trying to achieve this goal. It should not be used in the decision problem. But what statistical science tells us is that it is possible, even though these things aren't directly relevant, that they might provide information about a relevant unobserved thing and therefore be useful. So if we go back to our particular characteristics in this case, intuitively, and I think this is where a lot of the belief in anti-discrimination comes from, people look at that table and they feel, okay, the top line is relevant, so we should be using those characteristics. The bottom line, as being non-merit characteristics, is irrelevant. So we shouldn't be discriminating on the grounds of race, sex, age, clothing, favourite breakfast cereal, or anything like that. What statistics tells us is that that's not the case, that these non-merit characteristics in category R might be useful to infer the unobserved merit characteristics in category Y. So when exactly does that happen? And what are the principles by which, what does statistical science tell us is the criteria for when that happens? So the first principle here I want to talk about is just really an explanation of what rational discrimination is, when it occurs. Discrimination is rational in the kind of context that I've been describing if, conditional on all the information you have, those characteristics in R are statistically related to characteristics in Y, meaning perhaps that they're correlated, they have a tendency to occur with each other, or maybe if they're negatively correlated, they have a tendency to not occur with each other. So long as those characteristics are statistically related, it's rational to use one as a predictor of the other in this kind of predictive inference. So, for example, in the case of our taxi driver, if it's true that race, sex, and age are correlated with crime in that particular area, 1980s Washington, D.C., it is rational to use those characteristics not because they're directly relevant in their own right, but because they give us some information, albeit imperfect information, about a thing which is relevant. Am I going to be bashed up by this passenger? And indeed, one of the interesting things that came out of these kinds of studies was that it was found that the taxi drivers that were acting in this discriminatory way included taxi drivers who were themselves black. They were just as inclined to discriminate against young black men. So it did not seem the case that this was motivated by some kind of racist bigotry, or indeed if it was, it would be a very masochistic form if the same people are discriminating against their own race in this way, but more likely it is explained by this kind of statistical phenomena, that taxi drivers, whatever their race, recognise that at that particular time and place, young black men were a high-risk group, meaning that those things were positively correlated with crime, and therefore they were using that as a predictor, an imperfect predictor, but they had to use the very small amount of information they had in that context. So this first principle tells us when rational discrimination occurs. A second important principle about rational discrimination is a principle I call causal irrelevance. It turns out, in this kind of statistical application, this is what we call a predictive inference, meaning the taxi driver isn't making any intervention. Unlike in economic theory, where we're interested in the causal effects of actions, in statistical science, we often look at situations where we're passively observing things and simply attempting to predict them without making any intervention ourselves. And in those cases of passive prediction, it turns out that what matters is statistical relationships between things, correlation, for example. What doesn't matter is the underlying causal links between those things. So the principle of causal irrelevance in this context tells us this form of rational discrimination arises regardless of whether you believe that those characteristics in category R have a causal effect on those characteristics in category Y. It actually doesn't matter. So to put that in the context of the taxi driver, he doesn't care whether young black men are a high-risk group because of poverty, poor male role models, etc., or whether it's something much more causal than that. To the taxi driver, it is irrelevant what the causal reason is. They are correlated for some reason. And for his point of view, from his perspective of simply trying to make a prediction, causality there is not important. Now, the reason this is interesting is a lot of people who argue against, for example, race discrimination, believe that race discrimination is an inherently racist phenomenon. But when we analyse this relationship between cause and correlation, we see there's a bit more going on than that. So I'm going to give here a working definition of racism, and this is brought out of, it didn't originate with her, but I think it's explained quite well in an article by Ayn Rand, although she didn't invent the definition, is just explaining it, and which is the thesis that belief or behaviour is directly determined by genetic factors and hence follows along racial lines. Now, Rand explains this by saying, for example, that it's not racist to believe that perhaps the cognitive apparatus of a person or their other physical characteristics follows genetically, but racism is defined by the belief that the contents of the mind, the beliefs, the contents of the mind, as opposed to the instrument, the apparatus, is that those ideas are following along genetically. This kind of idea is present in forms of polylogism, for example, where people will say, well, there's certain ideas which are black ideas or white ideas and so on, and therefore ideas are following genetically down. Now, whether you agree with this definition or not, that's the definition I'm going to proceed with. So essentially this thesis would be saying that race causes crime. Now, obviously, if a person believed that, it would follow that race would be correlated with crime, and hence discrimination would follow as a consequence of that belief. But it's important to understand that it is certainly not necessary to have that belief to believe that discrimination in that kind of context is justified. And this is going back to the principle of causal irrelevance, that it is simply not relevant for that kind of predictive inference whether race causes crime or whether race is merely correlated with crime for some other reason. So this is the principle of causal irrelevance. Another thing that's poorly understood about discrimination, but which statistics tells us a bit more about, is this principle of unequal representation. You will sometimes hear people say that in the absence of discrimination, or in the absence perhaps of bad kinds of discrimination, outcomes should be equal, subject only to small statistical variations. So if, for example, a certain demographic group is 10% of the population, they should be 10% of company CEOs, 10% of Supreme Court judges, 10% of government ministers, etc. Obviously subject to some random fluctuations, but broadly speaking, there should be this kind of equality of outcome. It turns out there's good reasons to believe that that is not a sensible expectation. Unequal representation can occur for a couple of reasons. Obviously, if there's discrimination occurring, that itself can change the outcomes. If you're discriminating on the basis of race, then you won't necessarily get equality of outcomes across racial groups. But what's interesting is that even without discrimination occurring, if, for example, we go back to our taxi driver, and if, he, for example, he's in an area where he believes there just isn't any correlation between race, sex, age, clothing, and crime, none of those things are relevant here, and he doesn't discriminate, it's still quite possible that outcomes won't be equally representative because those characteristics could still be correlated with the characteristics in group X, the other merit characteristics. And in that case, we still do get inequality of outcome. So an example I see is, I teach engineering students a lot at university, and that's a very male-dominated group. It's probably about 80 to 90% of the students I teach in those classes are male, yet obviously nowhere near 90% of the population is male. Now, that can come about for something as innocuous as perhaps males like engineering more and are more inclined to apply to those programs. So you can have a correlation simply between those kinds of demographic criteria and other merit characteristics. And so there's no reason to believe that absent discrimination, there ought to be equality of outcome proportional to people's representation in the population. This is something, by the way, that the economist Thomas Sowell has studied a lot. And he's looked at a lot of empirical evidence for this and finds essentially that equality of outcome is almost never occurs and in fact tends only to occur when it's coercively imposed from the top. And even in processes where it simply cannot possibly be the case of that inequality of outcome is due to discrimination, still it exists. An example of that would be that in the US, for example, Hispanics are 3 or 4 times more likely to be struck by lightning than other racial groups. I think you would have a hard time attributing that to discrimination. The reason that happens, incidentally, is a fairly simple one, that happens to be correlated with other things that do affect being struck by lightning. A lot of Hispanics work on building sites, high on buildings, not necessarily with the best safety standards always, and so they're a higher risk group in the sense they expose themselves more to the danger of that. And so in those kinds of situations, and many more besides, you can see clearly that equal outcomes is not a sensible expectation. I think one of the things that drives the belief that discrimination is pervasive and bad, you'll sometimes hear people talking about that we live in a terribly racist society, and they will cite inequality of outcomes as evidence of that. And implicit in that kind of argument is the belief that, well, absent discrimination, it shouldn't look like that. But actually, we find that there's not really any reason to expect equality of outcome simply because of the absence of discrimination. Now, this kind of establishes a logical case for discrimination based on just essentially the principles of statistical inference. And in fact, it's interesting that some of the more sophisticated advocates of anti-discrimination law quite readily accept everything I'm saying here, or at least everything I've said so far. They readily accept that this phenomenon of rational discrimination does exist, that that's a logical process. It's a better way to try and infer those characteristics than if you didn't discriminate. But nonetheless, they are not comfortable with that. And what tends to be the case, and in fact what you see argued explicitly sometimes, is that this is perhaps rational but not moral. It's rationally okay, and yes, okay, we can see it's rational, but it's still morally problematic. And there are aspects of that that are very plausible. For example, if you're discriminating on the grounds of, say, race, sex, age, these are characteristics that a person has not chosen. They have no capacity to choose those characteristics, to change those characteristics. So from their point of view, they're stuck. And if you're a young black man in early 1980s Washington, D.C., when this was occurring, a characteristic you haven't chosen, as soon as you meet a taxi driver or whoever else, it screams to them, "Look out, I am statistically more likely to do bad things to you." And this is a characteristic you've not chosen, so that's a very difficult thing to deal with. And obviously, in view of the fact this is not a chosen characteristic, it can't possibly be a view on the merits of that person. If they haven't chosen this characteristic, we can't say that this is a bad thing that they've done. And so a lot of advocates of the anti-discrimination paradigm say that, yes, this is rational discrimination, but it remains immoral. One of those, a woman called Professor Deborah Hellman, she's written a book called When Is Discrimination Wrong? She makes the argument that rational discrimination, though rational, ought to be prohibited anyway because it's demeaning to people, that to be treated differently on the grounds of race, sex, age, etc., is inherently demeaning and is treating people not as moral equals in the world. Now, in my view, that does not take the inference that's occurring in that situation seriously. It doesn't take it for what it really means. In the kind of example that I've just given you, there's no suggestion that those characteristics in group R are bad characteristics. What we're saying is that there are perhaps characteristics in group Y that are bad characteristics, and the characteristics in group R happen to be correlated with those, and hence we can use them for prediction. So there's no suggestion implicit in that inference saying you are bad because of this non-merit characteristic. Rather, the inference says, I don't know whether you're good or bad. Unfortunately, I have very limited information in this decision problem. I can only guess and infer that. And these other characteristics you have, unchosen, I know to be correlated with those things. So there's no suggestion, in my view, of any kind of insult to the person by doing this. And again, coming back to the fact that this kind of discrimination was also practiced by black taxi drivers, it would be odd if they intended that as an insult. Having been young black men themselves previously, it would be odd if they intended to demean the young black men who they were passing up in a taxi there. So I think Hellman is wrong when she suggests that this is demeaning. I think, in actual fact, when you understand that inferential process, it does not imply any insult to that person. As a consequence of this being logical behaviour, and in my view not demeaning, I think it's then fairly evident that this is also morally legitimate. And I guess I take the view here that morality and justice towards other people is simply the rational evaluation of those people. What you owe to other people morally, to do them justice, is to evaluate them rationally based on whatever information you have. You can't be expected to have information that you don't, and so all that is required of you in a moral sense is to be able to use the information you do have as best as possible. So, I mean, in this kind of situation, I suppose, it's a matter of putting yourself in the shoes of the taxi driver, whether or not you're a party that's adversely affected by that, putting yourself in the shoes of the taxi driver. I think a lot of people who are adversely affected by discrimination of this kind think, that's not fair. I'm a good guy. I'm not going to rob this taxi driver. Why should I be passed up for a taxi? I'm a good guy. What fails to be appreciated in that attitude is, that's all very well, but you can't reasonably expect this other person to know that. They don't have the information that you have about your character. All that can really be expected of us is to evaluate people according to the information that we can actually obtain in that situation. Now, that's a very controversial principle, that discrimination of the kind I've described is morally legitimate. So I'm going to raise the stakes a bit with an even more controversial principle. If this is correct, it not only follows that discrimination of that kind is morally legitimate, but that the failure to discriminate is immoral, that to not discriminate is immoral, insofar as it means failing to take account of all of the relevant information about a person that you have available to you, and therefore failing to do justice, failing to engage in the rational evaluation of another human being according to all of the available information. So I'll let you spin your wheels on that one. I won't say anything more about that now. The final principle I want to talk about pertaining to discrimination is it's sometimes thought to be a manifestation of collectivism. That to discriminate, for example, on the grounds of race or sex or something like that is a collectivist thing to do. It's judging people according to group membership rather than on their individual merits. Now, while it's certainly, obviously, I think, very good to judge people on their individual merits, that kind of wishes away the inference problem that's there, which is you don't know the individual merits, you can't possibly observe them in that situation. Now, this kind of process is a manifestation of individualism in the sense that the object of inference is still the individual characteristics of this person. So a collectivist attitude to this would be very different. A collectivist attitude would say, I'm not so interested in your individual merits one way or the other. If the group you're a member of overall is good or bad in this respect, I'm going to judge according to that. So I'm not attempting to make an inference from that group membership to your individual characteristics, I'm not interested in that. Whereas in the kind of rational discrimination situation I've described, that is the object of inference, and hence an example of individualism. Now, those things are pregnant with conclusions about the anti-discrimination paradigm. The only one I want to talk about is to say that it follows from this that anti-discrimination law and the entire philosophical paradigm behind it should not be viewed as a coercive means, a bad means to a good end, which is what some libertarians view it. They say, well, look, I don't like that it's coercive, that's bad, people should have the right, blah, 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 but it's a good end, we're trying to get rid of discrimination and that's good. I would say, no, we are overactive in what we're trying to get rid of. There is a subclass of discrimination. I certainly wouldn't want it to be thought that all discrimination is rational, but there is some of it which is perfectly rational, perfectly moral. And so anti-discrimination law then is a system of mandatory irrationality, which is how I like to describe this. So I'd like you to leave you with that thought of anti-discrimination law as a system of mandatory irrationality. Thank you very much.